Thank you, Moose. So we're going to switch gears somewhat. Rather than trying to give you a technical talk, I'm going to give you sort of a political talk. So have that in mind. We're not going to talk bits and bytes today. So back when dinosaurs and mainframes ruled the earth, when I was originally a programmer, I had the great benefit of sharing an office with Bill Joy, who started the original Berkeley Software Distribution. It was just called BSD. It's like rock groups, you know. They always put the name of their first album is the name of the group, and then they do a second album, and what are they going to do? So we should have called it one BSD, but it was just called BSD. But then the next one came out, and that was 2BSD, 3BSD, et cetera. In fact, we got as far as 4BSD, and the next obvious thing would be 5BSD, except that AT&T had a conniption and said, oh, if you call it 5BSD, there'll be confusion with System 5. You can't call it 5BSD. So then it became 1, 4.1, 4.2, 4.3, et cetera. At any rate, Bill went and left the university to go become a co-founder of Sun Microsystems. And he said, pulled me into the office and said, you know, Kirk, you could be employee number 7 and you could get a huge stock option. But I had just recently finished my master's degree in business administration. And so I patiently explained to Bill that, you know, just people don't buy workstations, they buy applications. And Apollo has a complete lock on the application market on workstations. So there's no chance you can succeed. So I'm going to stay at the university and get my PhD. Therefore, I am not a multi-billionaire today. But it did mean that I got to take over the BSD project and got to become the grand omnipotent high stomper, the Linus Torvalds equivalent of BSD, which position I had for 10 years. And roll back to the previous talk, this thing called burnout. It's a problem when you cannot go on vacation because everything comes to a screeching halt because you are not around. And so you have to be available 24/7. And that gets kind of old after a while. And so as we were finishing up the project at Berkeley, we were getting it out in open source. We had a little lawsuit to deal with, you know, a few other things. But eventually it's out there. And I wanted BSD to continue, but I realized it couldn't be me that was in charge of it because I was utterly burned out. And I wanted to see if there could be a way it could be set up so that it would be self-sustaining, so that, you know, I could disappear off the face of the planet and it would continue to grow and so on. And so I became very interested in this thing of how do you actually build and run an open source community? How do you actually structure it in such a way that it takes on a life of its own? And I'm going to use the FreeBSD project as my example of this because I've had a lot of personal experience with it. But the takeaway from this talk is really how do you build such a community? How do you build such a self-sustaining operation? Okay, well, I can't, of course, get away without giving you a little bit of an introduction to what BSD is. It's the open source operating system that was derived from 4.4 BSD Lite. The Dash Lite was in contrast to the 4.4 BSD Encumbered, which was the one that you had to have an AT&T source license for. So it was like light beer from Miller. It's the one that doesn't have the AT&T part in it. We released that in 1992. We fought a little bit of a lawsuit for a couple of years and eventually won. And so then, as part of the settlement of the lawsuit, we had to re-release one that didn't have any of that contaminated code. Actually, the first one didn't, but we had to agree that it did to, you know, placate them. And so it was this great settlement meeting where it's like, well, you know, what are you removing? And I'm just thinking to myself, well, there really isn't anything to remove. And so the lawyers sort of call me out of the room and say, look, it's not about whether there's really something to remove. Just find something, say that it is, and that you'll remove it, and we'll release it without that in there. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I've always hated Shamem. Let's just take the implementation of Shemem and throw it out. And, you know, maybe if it's not in there, we will never have to put it back. Well, that part didn't work out. But anyway, we re-released it. And the idea was, of course, then that everybody that had been using the previous one couldn't use it anymore, and they had to go to the new one. And I think AT&T secretly thought that was going to derail everything. Well, it didn't. And in fact, we got some more bug fixes out, which was kind of cool. Anyway, there immediately two groups sprang up. Well, actually, Bill Jolett started by filling in the missing files, sort of like Minix, where there was just this buildup of patch sets and patch sets and more patch sets because he wasn't really dealing with them. Eventually, people got tired of that, and so two groups were created almost simultaneously, which was FreeBSD and NetBSD. The NetBSD folks really wanted to stay on what they viewed as an academic focus, a small, lean system that ran on a very wide range of processors. And the FreeBSD folks that said, you know, we don't care about all those obscure architectures. It's all about the PC and getting things that are installable for people. And so they sort of went their own ways, and they've sort of converged back. You know, FreeBSD now supports multiple architectures, and NetBSD actually has CD-ROMs that you can install. there's a lot of cross-pollination that goes on. Now, I'll observe that it is one of the very few open-source projects that is still active after more than 20 years. If you look at SourceForge or GitHub, there's a huge amount of stuff there, and most of it is dark. And dark is defined as a project that has not had a single commit done to it for more than a year. It's essentially a project that's just moribund. Nothing's going on with it. And 80, 90% of the projects that are on those places falls into that category. The typical thing that you see is you get someone gets a great idea, and they go out and they get some people that are working with them, and they do a bunch of stuff, and then they just sort of lose interest and it goes away. So how do you build something that doesn't have that property? And there was actually an interesting study that was done by some economists. A couple of them were based at MIT, and a couple of them were at the University of Toulouse in the south of France. These four economists went through and they studied a huge number of these open source projects, which is easy to do because they could simply go through the source code control logs and see who was doing commits, and from that could build up and say, all right, this is clearly a person that's, you know, doing a lot and is in charge and blah, blah, blah. And what they found was that the most common cause of failure was that the person that started the project lost interest in it, and that was the end of it. A few projects managed to actually have the leader fall off and some other people sort of take on, and they would do it. It would often sort of sputter along for a while longer, but without the sort of overarching view of the leader, they also would fizzle out. They found, this is some years ago now, two projects that had managed to have five or more sets of leadership. Those two projects were the FreeBSD project and Apache. They are the only ones that have managed to succeed at that. Linux is still on their first leader. They haven't managed to do a transition even of that yet. So they're going to need to think about this. What you also find when you do have some of these longer term ones with a single leader is that you see the age of the people that are doing it going up and up and up. So if you look at the average age of the sort of the leadership of Linux, it's a lot older now than it was 10 years ago. And you need to keep bringing in youth. If you look at the average age of FreeBSD leadership today and the average age of the project, which I have some demographics on, it's the same as it was 10 years ago. In fact, slightly younger. Okay, what is FreeBSD? People say, oh, well, you know, the whole world is Linux. Well, actually, it turns out that there's a lot of the world that's FreeBSD. You just don't know it because it's things like the root name servers, the major hosts, web hosts and search engines, routing infrastructure, commercial operating systems like OS, a huge amount of Android, and a huge amount of the Apple stuff. So some of the users, Netflix, all of Netflix runs on FreeBSD. 30% of all the traffic on the internet worldwide is Netflix. It takes a lot of computing power to push that much stuff. Yahoo, Vero, BBC, the Internet Software Consortium, they're the people that do like DNS, that kind of stuff. Juniper, Network Appliance, EMC, Isilon, Panasis, et cetera. So the point is that this is, you know, it's not so much on the desktops, although PCBSD is finally managing to put together something that makes the desktop a plausible story for FreeBSD. All right, so let's start with how did we do things at Berkeley? Because it turns out that although it was primitive, we set a kernel of a way of building a system. I'll point out Linux is an operating system, and so FreeBSD is not just the operating system, it's all the stuff that sits on top of the operating system. So you can think of FreeBSD really more like you would think of a Red Hat distribution or a Debian distribution or whatever. Okay, so BSD started at University of California with Bill Joy in 1977. After a couple of years, they put together a thing called the Computer Systems Research Group, which was this group at Berkeley that coordinated the development of BSD. The core of CSRG, at its biggest, was four people. In 1970, contributions came in via tape or email. Email was running primarily over the UUCP dial-up phone network. Even back in those days, we were doing much more integration of what other people were doing than actually writing code ourselves. I mean, you obviously can't build a whole system with four people. You got to have other people helping you. In the early 1980s, this newfangled thing came out called a source code control system, and it was actually a thing called SCCS that originally came out of AT&T. And Bill Joy glommed onto this. He's like, oh, thank goodness, we finally have a way of managing stuff. And so everything got put under SCCS in 1980, and so we, in fact, have a complete set of everything that's ever changed in the BSDs from 1980s going forward. Unfortunately, we were forced to purge those in 1994 because of the lawsuit. And so if you look in the modern repositories today, they start from 1994. However, after the lawsuit settled, I was permitted to release the source code control files for things going all the way back to 1980. At any rate, we came up on the ARPANET. And I'm not going to tell the whole ARPANET story, but that's the thing that eventually evolved into what's the internet today. What's more interesting to me is how did we deal with all the stuff coming in over the barrels? I mean, originally people would send us stuff and then we'd have to integrate it and compile it and make sure it all worked and so on. And with four people, that was pretty soon completely overwhelming. And so once we had the ARPANET, we could give accounts to people on the machine, and then they could log in. And since we had source code control, we could see what they were doing. So there were about 10 people that we trusted, and they, in turn, would have like a large number of people that would be working with them. And so they were integrating stuff and then logging in and checking it into the source code control system. And then when we would get ready to do a distribution, we would literally go through and have the entire set of diffs from the previous distribution to the current distribution. I mean, that sounds crazy today, but you know, it was a stack of paper about like that, and then we would just divide it up and go through line by line by line, looking at every single diff that anybody had put in and go, yeah, ooh, what's this about, you know, and et cetera. And so having sort of vetted everything that had happened, we would then turn the crank and put out another distribution. So this notion of a central source code repository, people coming in, watching the commits that were going on, really sort of formed the basis for the project. Now, we had a single machine. We had, like, everybody had an account on the machine. It obviously would not scale to what we need to do today, but it set sort of a model for building this. Okay, roll forward now to the FreeBSD project. We do not use a distributed source code control system. We still use a central code source code repository, in this case Subversion. But there are a lot of people that want to do the distributed stuff. So Subversion, every time something checks into Subversion, it feeds into a Git repository, and that Git repository is mirrored on about 40 sites worldwide. So you can just download that and work from it. And that's the way a lot of people choose to do things. Anyone can anonymously download the Subversion or the Git trees, and only people that are committers are allowed to update the Subversion. And you have to submit it. There's a machine that runs nothing but Subversion. You can't even log into the machine, but you can send up the Subversion and it maintains that central repository. If you are a committer, you get an email for every commit that is done, about 300 a day. The core system of FreeBSD is composed of about 100 libraries and about 775 utilities, plus the kernel itself. The primary architectures which are supported, so-called first tier, are Intel and AMD 32 and 64 bits, ARMs, MIPS, PowerPC, and Spark. My guess is that Spark is not long for this world, but that's largely because of what happened with Sun. There's obviously a huge amount of additional software, and that is maintained in the so-called ports collection, and that, I'm told I'm out of date. It's 25,000 packages that are in the ports. Now, because FreeBSD tends to be used in situations where it's either a large server situation or more commonly as part of an embedded product. So something like network appliance, when you buy the network appliance box, the operating system's actually running in that box is FreeBSD with all the stuff that they add to it. So when you build an embedded product, it takes you about 2 years from when you grab the distribution, get all your stuff integrated, go through all the quality control and regression and all the rest of it you need to do, and start getting it produced and shipping it out to people. It's about a two-year period before it first goes out the door, and you are certainly hope to have that product supported in the field for, let's say, 5 years maybe. And so you need to have a system that is still being maintained, FreeBSD, from up to 7 years ago. So we can't just say, oh, here's the new release, the old one, that's history, bye, sorry. So in fact, what ends up happening is that we have this notion of the current tree, that's the vertical arrow you see there, and the top, the thing that says current, that's the bits du jour. And in fact, on my, not my main machine that I depend on, but on my test machine, every night at 2 a.m., I download the current version of the system as of that instant in time, compile, do what's called make world, build the entire thing, install world, and reboot. And so when I come in the morning, my test machine is running the bits du jour, or occasionally it's sitting at a boot prompt. at any rate, that's current. And anything that you're checking in, no matter what it is, has to start by being checked into current. And then it goes through at least a 3-day bake-in tinderbox where it gets compiled for every architecture. People get a little chance to experience it so that we can make sure that you haven't done something that's just completely causing grief. From that point on, many things that are sort of in active development never move out of current. They will eventually become part of a distribution, but they are not brought down to one of the existing ones. We maintain three distributions back. So at the moment, we have the 7, 8, and 9 distributions, and then current, which will next cut to 10, probably early next year. So then what will happen is that if you have something that's, a bug fix, let's say, or a bug is reported in 9, you figure out what the problem is, you first check your bug fix in at current, and then once it's proven to not cause bad things to happen, we then do what's called an MFC, move from current. And so you'll do an MFC of that change down into 9, and if it's relevant, it can also go down to 8 and 7. And so then what ends up happening is that that 9 distribution is going out there, and there's what's called 9 stable. So Nine stable is everything that's been checked into the nine branch. And then periodically, every 6 months to 6 to 9 months, a new snapshot is made of the stable, the nine stable branch. So the next one that's just about to come out will be 9.2. And 9.2, you say, well, if you know, you can just grab the stable part. But what happens is with 9.2, we make sure it compiles. We make sure that every single port will compile with that thing, that we have packages built for that. So there's just a lot of sort of polishing that goes on. And if you're a vendor that has something that's in the field, you don't want to be dealing with like updating every day. You know, every 6 months or so, you say, all right, here's a set of things that are, you know, we need to consider putting into our product, and then they will do that. Now, the rate at which things go from head into nine is fairly quick. The most recent stable release gets updates to device drivers to, you know, deal with the latest NVIDIA or whatever. Whereas things that are further down the tree, like eight, doesn't get nearly as many things added to it. It tends to get only things that are truly bugs, or if there's a security advisory, of course, all of the branches will get that. And seven, even less so. Seven really just gets any serious bug or security vulnerabilities fixed in it. The seven stable branch, I see a change go into that like once a month, maybe. Eight, there's a handful a week, more than a handful a week, a handful a day. And nine is got fairly actively having things put into it. But if you're a vendor and you've got something in the field, it's been out in the field probably by 4 years, if you've got seven in there, you're just not interested in new device drivers. You're interested in like, oh, there's a security vulnerability, yeah, we should probably get that in. And so the reason that we have seven is not because the desktop people want to be running seven. You'd be crazy, you probably couldn't even get it to work with the video card you had. But if you've got some product out in the field, you care about seven. And so keeping all these things going back is actually a lot of work. And so, you know, it's a lot easier. Most distributions, it's just you get the current one and that's it. You know, that's the notion of keeping all these branches going back for three branches is something that is a lot of work to do. But we do it because of the people using FreeBSD need that in order to be able to utilize it. Okay, so release engineering, the major releases are every 2 to 3 years, the minor releases every 6 to 10 months, and as I say, on those stable, you can, you know, download an update to the end of this, you know, to the bits du jour of the stable tree at any time. So if you just, it's convenient to do an upgrade, you know, now, you can do it. You don't have to wait for it to come out in a dot release. It takes about a 1 week freeze on the tree to do the changes for a minor release cutover. It takes about a 1 month freeze on head. So the reason you only want to cut head every 2 to 3 years is because you pretty much have to tell people, all right, you know, stop putting new stuff into the system now. You know, let's stabilize anything that we have or back it out if you're not going to be able to get it ready in a month's time, so that we can have cut that branch. Then once the branch gets cut, you know, head goes back to being what it was before, and the actual stabilization for the release will be done on that branch. Okay, the freeze period gets determined jointly by the release engineering and QA teams, which I'll talk about later. And the cycle is we do two betas, beta 1, beta 2, and then after that we start to hope that we're going to actually get the real thing. I think once ever release candidate 1 actually passed, because the problem is a lot of people don't run the beta. They don't run it until we do a release candidate, and then it's like, oh, problems. It's like, you know, you could have. Never mind. So release candidate 2. Release candidate 3. Unfortunately, the 9.2 is on release candidate 4 at the moment, but you know, you get the idea. All right, so that's the milieu that we're living in. Now, the trick is how do we make that all work? So let's change gears again and let's look at the FreeBSD community. The FreeBSD community, lest you have any illusions, is volunteers. Now, volunteers have a number of properties associated with them. Number one is they only do what they want to do. Because they're volunteers after all. If they, you know, you say, you know, I want you to go down and do this incredibly tedious, boring thing, they're like, I don't think so. I don't want to do that. I want to do this exciting thing over here. So, you know, you just have to sort of get this through your head. You know, this is not like a work situation where you can just have someone say, you do this and you do that. People do what they want to do, and, you know, it makes it very hard to have a roadmap because, you know, you don't really know what you're going to have until it's like, oh, well, it's time to do a release. What do we have now? Okay, well, this is what we have, so that's what we're doing. That's not strictly true, but to a first-order approximation, that's the way it works. The second thing is with volunteers that it's the lowest priority. It comes after work. It comes after family. It comes after vacations. Whatever residual time is left, that's what you get. And so they may be really excited about doing something, but something blows up at work, and so it just doesn't happen. Or, well, they're going on vacation this month. Sorry. What I'm sort of trying to get across to you is that you can't really have a schedule. You can sort of look at what's going on. You can create lists of things you'd like to see done. So you should have a vision for where you're trying to get to. You know, people come along and say, well, I want to volunteer. We have a list. Go to freebsd.org. How can I get involved? There's a list of things we'd love to have done, and we hope that one of those appeals to you and you want to do it. But the fact of the matter is that things get done when they get done, and that's about all you can plan on. The most important, if non-obvious thing, is that volunteers are transient. People get excited about something, they get involved, they do a bunch of stuff, and then they lose enthusiasm, or some new shiny thing comes along and that gets their attention, and that's where their free time goes. And the fact of the matter is that people that work on any open source project, the average time that people work on FreeBSD is 3.5 years. There's obviously a big tail of people that have worked on it for a long time. There's a lot of people that come in and there's like one thing that really excites them, and they do that, and then that's it. They're gone. You need to deal with this, because if you're not careful, you end up with a huge amount of dead wood, and that will sink the ship. So you've got to have some scheme in place to deal with transient. Okay, so what are the goals? Well, it's got to be self-organizing, because we don't have paid staff. We don't have management. And somehow things sort of have to get themselves organized. One of the things that has been very important to me personally, and one of the things that I've really driven to make sure that it happens, is that we have to have an egalitarian and merit-based advancement. The biggest problem that you get with open source communities is that you've got the grand omnipotent high stomper and the set of lieutenants, and you can't be any of those people. You can rise to a certain level, and then that's it. You're not going to be Linus, and you're not going to be one of his lieutenants. Sorry. And so you want to set up a system whereby if you want to be and you're successful at it, you can be the grand omnipotent high stomper. And that is the case in FreeBSD. Now, it's like saying, you know, any American citizen can become president. You know, there's a lot of them where it's really clear they are never going to become president. That's true in any other project as well. But you can't say to someone, you can never be president, because then it's, you know, the organized boss that's telling people what's going on. So there is no organized boss that tells people what's going on. You just can't have it set up that way, because that just doesn't work. Okay, and this transientness means that you've got to anticipate turnover and manage it gracefully. And again, it's a fact of life in a project. You've got to have a way of getting rid of the dead wood. And it cannot appear to be that there is this cabal of people that is like running around and, you know, zapping the dead wood, or, you know, the people they don't like. So it's quite a, you know, you look at this and you go, well, how in the world are you ever going to make this work? Well, keep listening. How do we have it organized? Well, we start with users. We have some number of millions of users. I love it when open source people say, oh yes, we've got 6.4 million users. Like, well, where'd that number come from? It's like, well, you know, we look at downloads. It's like, uh-huh. You know, I mean, anybody can download this stuff, you know, it's like, and then they take the download and they multiply by some number. And it's like, well, for every download, there's 10 users. Like, oh yeah, sure, uh-huh. Or, you know, for every download, you know, we're going to be conservative. There's only half of those ever get used. Uh-huh. I mean, it's a fudge factor. So you sort of kind of maybe know how many downloads you have. I mean, we've got 40 mirror sites, most of which are not run by the project, many of which don't collect statistics on downloads. So, you know, we don't even know how many downloads we have, let alone what we ought to multiply by. But we've got millions of downloads that we do know about, and so, you know, therefore we must have millions of users. Anyway, users send and receive feedback on bugs. They can monitor mailing lists. There's some help, you know, general help mailing lists that they can send stuff to. But in essence, you know, they're not directly contributing into the project for the most part. They're necessary. You want them. I mean, that's your ultimate goal, is to have users, but they're not actually involved in the core of getting stuff done. So the core of getting stuff done starts with developers. And we have about 6,000 developers when I last looked. And they have read access to the source code from Subversion or Git, and they can submit changes. Now, in order to submit a change, the only people that can actually put the change in is a committer. So how do you submit changes? Well, you've got the source code control log, so you can look and see, you know, I've been working on this set of files, and look, here's, you know, this person has made a whole lot of changes to that. So they must have some clue of what's going on there. And the name that's there, at freebsd.org, is always a legitimate mailing address. That's by definition, because you're a committer, therefore you have that as a mailing address. So you send mail to that person. Now, they may in fact just be, you know, have transiently been doing something, but they're going to know who's in charge of that. So they're either the one in charge or they're going to know who the person in charge. You can fairly quickly find out who you should be sending your changes to, and you send it to them. And changes that come in from people that are not really clued into the way that we do things on the project are often not exactly the way that it should be dealt with. And so there's usually an iteration, you know, they look at it, they sort of understand what the thing is trying to get done, and so they'll often work back and forth with the developer to develop a commit that's actually one that would pass muster to go in for the project, and then they will eventually commit it. And in the log, they'll say, you know, contributed by, and, you know, there's no end to the good you can do in the world by giving credit to other people. So at any rate, what will happen is a lot of these people, you know, they send in one or two commits, and that's the last you ever hear of them. But some people, they start sending, you know, oh, that worked. Yeah, it's kind of fun. And pretty soon, the committer's like, they're spending half their time dealing with this one developer. They go, you know, I think you should become a committer. And so they nominate that person to become a committer, and we'll talk about how all that works in a minute. So committers. We have 312 of these people at the moment. Most are authorized to commit changes to specific ports for which they assume to agree responsibility. The average ports committer has approximately 10 ports that they are in charge of maintaining. And that number has probably gone up actually recently. At any rate, when you get a commit privilege, you get a commit privilege to a particular thing. It's not like you get a commit privilege, so now you can change anything you want. Ooh, power. No, it doesn't quite work that way. So you get commit privileges in certain areas, and as I said, the vast majority of the committers are maintaining ports. Any change requires review by at least one other committer. If I want to change the UFS file system, which I first wrote in 1982, I still have to find another committer to review a change before I put it into that code. And it turns out that that's really a good thing because, you know, sometimes you just do something that's like, that's really stupid, you know? You really didn't mean to do that, did you? It's like, so it's a good thing, even for stuff you've worked on for a long time. When a commit gets put in, it gets mailed to all the committers, and in the commit message is who reviewed it. And so you can't just like make this up and say, oh, Kib reviewed it for me, because Kib's going to get that. And he's going, I didn't review that. What are you talking about? So you really do have to do it. Okay, as I said already, it's a gateway to feed in developer changes. And what ends up happening is when a developer starts doing enough stuff that he's overwhelming his committer or just seems like someone who's generally got the idea, then they get nominated to become a committer themselves. There's a core group, which I'll get to, that actually blesses and says, yes, you can become a committer. Now, just because we give you committer privileges doesn't necessarily mean that you really sort of fully understand the way the system works. And so a part of nominating committer is that you also have to nominate a mentor for that committer. And that's usually the person who does the nomination, but there are some people that just aren't really that good as mentors. And so in some cases, there's someone else will be the mentor for that person, or it may be that the area that they're actually committing into, there's someone else that just is sort of more in tune to that area. Okay, so that's the way you get new committers in. Now that's great, more and more and more committers, and it grows to an ever larger size until most of them aren't doing anything, and you see where this is going. So we need to have a way to get rid of the dead wood. And the way that we get rid of the dead wood is that we have this rule that says there's an automatic suspension of your commit privileges after 1 year of non-use. So if you haven't committed anything for a year, then we just say, okay, well, you're obviously on to other things, and you're going to be suspended. Now, this is like a 1 millimeter high wall to get over. You get a warning about 2 months before it's going to happen saying, oh, you haven't committed anything, just so you know that your commit bit's going to go away in 2 months. So all you have to do is go and edit like the thing that says your personal log, like what I'm working on, or what my phone number is, or my address, or some just totally trivial thing. It's like less difficult than posting on Facebook. So people that want to keep their commit privilege, even though they aren't really doing very much, can show enough interest to do something like that, they can keep their commit. Okay, it means at least they're reading their email for the project. Okay, now after a year of non-use, it gets suspended. It gets put on hold. But for the next 6 months after that, you can get it back just by saying, oh, I was on a desert island and I'm back now, I want to do some more stuff. Okay, here it is. And it gives you another year after that. Okay, after 18 months of non-use, it's gone. And if you want to come back to the project after that, you actually have to go through the whole routine all over again of getting nominated, of getting a mentor, of going through that process. And the reason for this is that the way the project work changes over time. So, you have someone that has been gone from the project for a long period of time, say Jordan Hubbard, who's just come back to the project. I don't know how many of you know that he left Apple and is now working for iX Systems. He now wants to come back to the project. Well, when he was there, we used CVS, and now we use Subversion. And Subversion doesn't work the same way that CVS, thank God, worked. So the point is that he needs to learn what the new stuff is. We have it's much more structured now with the mentors and things which weren't around then. And there's just a whole lot more stuff that you need to know. So you really want somebody to help get you up to speed. Jordan probably doesn't need mentoring on how you should send stuff to mailing lists, but he probably does need just on a lot of the mechanics and the checkoffs and just all the stuff that goes on. So even Jordan gets a mentor. Now, I'm guessing that he'll get through his mentoring period in probably record time, a couple weeks ought to do it. But the point is that you just go through that process just, again, to get you up to speed with the way the project works. So what is the age demographic of the FreeBSD project committers? The mean age is 36, median age is 35, so it's pretty much what you'd expect as a curve. The youngest is 21, the oldest is 64. I'm not that person, but there's only one person between me and that number. The big hump is 26 to 46. And that is actually, I just recalculated this, and the last time it was 27 to 48. So it's actually come down a bit in the last 2 years since I last computed it. So you'll notice when I say most is 26, the people coming onto the project are coming in typically in their mid to late 20s. The biggest set of people that we have coming in are coming from the Linux community. They've risen as far as they can in the Linux community. They have often spent 6-12 months trying to get something in, and they're just bashing their head on the wall, and they're just frustrated. And so they're looking around for something else that they can do, and we're there. And they can see, you know, they're going to get a commit bit, and they are going to be able to commit into the central repository, which is the actual thing that ships out, and they don't really get that with Linux. So the benefit of having them be this age is that they've got 10 years of development under their belt, so they really know what they're doing. And they're old enough that they've gotten over the adolescent flame wars on mailing lists is fun part of their life. And so we tend to have a much more well-structured mailing list. Now, part of that is because we simply don't tolerate ad hominem attacks on the mailing list. If that kind of stuff starts up, it gets squelched. And if people don't get it through their head that they can't do that, they lose their commit bit. Initially for a week, then for 2 weeks, then for 4 weeks. There are a few, two people that have had to be banned for life over the life of the project. But, you know, you don't like to have to do that. Usually, you know, a timeout in the corner for a week is enough to get the message across. Okay, so this, you know, we tend to have more mature developers that are working on it, and you know, they've sort of gotten also past the point of their life where it's like they're measured by how many lines of code they can write. They sort of get the idea that a small number of really good lines is better than a large number of not so good lines. Okay, so continuing up at the very top, we have what's called the core team, and this is composed of 9 people. Now, originally, the core was the 4 of us at the CSRG, and when the FreeBSD project first started, they realized that they needed somebody, some set of people that were going to oversee, you know, the sort of final decision making that goes on in the project, but they were core for life. And so what ended up happening was that they, you know, sort of got in there, and some of them started sort of losing interest and not really doing what they needed to do, and so then they brought on another couple people. But it was pretty clear that we needed to somehow have a methodology for turning over core, just like we have for turning over committers. And so I will say I was not on the original core. I will not run for core. I will never be on core. I did my 10 years. Thank you very much. Okay. So I stand back and sort of, you know, I pontificate on what I think ought to be done, but nobody has to listen to me and usually don't. Okay. At any rate, but one of the things that I saw was that we really needed to deal with getting turnover in core. And so a couple of us got together and we came up with this idea of, why don't we make it an elected position? So we've got a set of committers, and we'll say that's the pool of eligible candidates. You can't just come out from nowhere and run for core. You have to have been a commit. You have to be an active committer to run for this. And it will have an election every couple years, and then, you know, that elected set of people will be core for the next 2 years. So now this required a change in the bylaws. And the only way at that time that changing the bylaws could happen was if core voted to do it. Well, if you go to the people that are the dead wood, you know, if they were thinking about it, they would have stepped down already. But they don't want to step down because it's, you know, it's a nice thing to have on your resume, and, you know, there's prestige and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, they're not going to actually step down. So how are you ever going to get this in place? Well, what you have to do is you have to understand dead wood. Dead wood means they don't do anything. So you go to them and you say, look, we've got this great idea where we're going to nominate, we'll get new blood in core, but of course, anybody that's on core is grandfathered in. And they go, oh, yeah, that seems like a good idea. New blood would be good, and I'm grandfathered in, so it doesn't really affect me. And they vote to approve it. And so we did expand CORE. I think at that time it was 6. We went up to 9, so we got, you know, 3 new people in. And 2 years go by, and now it's time for our next election. And so we don't want to have a nominating committee because then it shows, you know, they have too much sway, and, you know, so it's all self-nomination. But it turns out you actually still need to have some people go around and prod a few people and say, you know, you really ought to run for CORE, you know. You have to self-nominate yourself, but, you know, just do it. So anyway, one of the things you want to do is you want to sort of look at the existing CORE and see, you know, who's going to step down or wants to run again or whatever. And so, of course, I take this on as my job. So I go around to these people and I say, so are you planning on running for CORE this time? And they sort of look at me strangely, like, well, you know, I'm grandfathered. Why are you asking me this question? I said, well, yeah, you were grandfathered for the first term, but that was just the first term. Because, of course, they're dead. Boy, they didn't actually read the thing that they voted on. Two of these people will not speak to me to this day. If they see me across the room, they turn around and walk the other way. It's kind of weird after more than a decade. But anyway, we now have a completely elected CORE. In order to run for CORE, you'd simply raise your hand and say, I want to do it. So there's no group that's blessing people or, you know, a nominating committee slate or any of the rest of it. It's just anybody wants to run, they run. You get a, you know, there's a web page, and you get, you know, if you want your picture there, and you can have a statement about why they ought to elect you, and you can do as much or as little electioneering as you want. What's sort of probably going to be obvious when I describe what CORE does is it's a management job. You know, it's interpersonal relations stuff. And there are many people that are really awesome coders, but they really don't work and play well with others. You know, they just, the interpersonal thing is just not their forte. But they don't really realize that because they sort of think, well, I'm a great coder, which is true, and therefore I would obviously know what other coders ought to be doing, and I should be in management so I can tell them. These people, you know, the other committers are working with them, and they sort of know who the people are that are going to be good interpersonal people and who are the people that are going to not be so good. And amazingly, the people that have good interpersonal skills just always seem to get elected. It's amazing. But, you know, the people that don't get elected, you know, they can't complain that, you know, they didn't have the opportunity, that, you know, that because they, you know, there's just not a lot of things where they can't say, you know, somebody kept me from getting this. Well, they can say it, but, you know, no one believes them. Okay, so what is it that CORE does? Well, they maintain the FreeBSD roadmap. You actually have to have a vision for where you want things to go. What are we trying to do 3 years down the road? And so you have to set this out. You have to sort of come up with a way that we're going to get from here to there and maintain these various and sundry lists of things that need to be done so that people coming on can, you know, find projects to do that are going to help you get where you want to go. So then when we're getting ready to do these new releases, you have to review the project progress and draw up like the features list and, you know, say, how hard can that be? Well, there can be stuff in there that's sort of like half-baked. And you have to decide, are we going to be able to push this to completion before the release, or is this something that we should, you know, pull back and not try and get into the next release? And some of that involves talking to people, remember those volunteers and so on, finding out, you know, what's the probability this is going to happen, just sort of herding the cats to get people to tie up the loose ends, et cetera. It used to be more difficult to do this because everything was just in this big checked-in mash. Now what happens is any major new development is on a branch in Subversion, and so you develop along in your branch until you basically are ready, and then there's, you know, you have to actually, to bring one of those branches in, you've got to get an approval from CORE or at least a set of committers to bring that in. And if you're just about to do a distribution, they're going to say, no, really, no, not going to do that. Or, okay, you know, it's 3 months out, that looks, you know, enough of your cohorts have agreed that that's full enough, we'll bring it in. So the big pieces can be brought in or left out fairly easily these days. One of the hardest things that CORE has to do is resolve the differences between committers. You get two people, believe it or not, that can't agree on how something ought to be done. And so what ends up happening is you can sometimes end up with what are called commit wars. So somebody, person A commits something and then person B doesn't like it. So they remove that and put their version in and then they remove it. Then your microphone falls off. So you at some point, CORE has to step in and say, stop. We need to talk. And you try and get them to come to some resolution on how to fix it. And usually that's successful. Sometimes it's not. And you have to give them a timeout. But you know, generally speaking, these are people that are mature enough that they can sort of come to their senses. And then finally, there's the admitting and removing committers. That's primarily the process, of really just the mechanics of making sure the nominations are in place and the mentors are in place and that they look reasonable, that stuff has all been done reasonably and so on. And occasionally the timeouts, as I mentioned earlier. Okay, so what types of contributors do we have? Well, this is another area where the egalitarianism begins to become clear. In a lot of projects, there's this hierarchy. It's like, well, if you commit to the kernel, then you're really important. Whereas if you're only committing to, some port, then that's not as important. And documentation people, So this is not the case in the FreeBSD project. If you're a committer, it doesn't matter whether you commit to ports, to utilities, to the kernel, to documentation, to the QA, release engineering, sysadmin, advocacy. It doesn't matter. You are a committer. You are on the same standing as any other committer in the project. You are able to run for CORE. You get the same number of votes in voting for who should be in CORE, et cetera. So, we like to joke, the advocacy and marketing people, people that write code tend to have a bad view of marketing. Well, it turns out that marketing is actually kind of important. And there's a lot of bad marketing, just like there's a lot of bad code that gets written. But it turns out that there's some people that are really good at it. And luckily, we have 8 of these people on the project. And amazingly to me, one of them actually got not only nominated, but won a position on the CORE team, which really changed the way we started doing distributions. At any rate, let's start just sort of to describe it. We have the port maintainers. Now, some of these committers add up to more than 300, and that's because many people have multiple hats. You can have the right to do port commits and utility commits and kernel commits and so on and so forth. Okay, so there's 184 people that have port commit bits. They have done almost 23,000 commits in the last year. Utility maintainers, utilities is the stuff that's part of the CORE distribution. 170 of them made about 4,500 commits. There are 143 kernel committers that did about 7,000 commits. The documentation group is 108 committers that are in the documentation group. The documentation is one of the things that is a real strong suit of FreeBSD, which is rare in open source projects. It's sort of interesting how this came about. In the mid-90s, I was at a conference and I had someone come up to me and say, well, I'm really interested in the FreeBSD stuff and I'd really like to help, but actually I'm a documentation writer and I can't really write code, but I could help you with manual pages or something. Like, you're kidding. You're volunteering your time? Really? Cool. You are a committer. And I got them a commit bit like that and I was their mentor and it was easy. Actually, we didn't need mentors back then, so I just sort of was an unofficial mentor. Anyway, they started bringing their friends in because they said, hey, this is a really friendly place, and you can go and talk to coders. Well, one of the early projects they had was they wanted to document all the internal interfaces in the kernel. So this is the MAN9 section. So, you want to know what VOP under remove does. Well, MAN VOP under remove, and out it comes. But, you know, they had to get, you know, there was zero documentation on this stuff. And so they had to talk to the people that were the kernel maintainers. And they said, hey, these people will actually talk to you and give you the time of day and be helpful and give you feedback. And so anyway, it's built up to 108 of these committers. And the FreeBSD handbook is a thing of beauty. And it's actually up to date, amazingly, because they just keep cranking that stuff out. QA is an area that we have only recently gotten going. If you were a commercial company, that's core important. Unfortunately, it's taken us a while to find somebody that was really willing to lead that project. But we're getting some traction there. Release engineering is something we've had for a very long time. That was stuff that we did back in Berkeley days, and we've always done that well. System administrators, we've got 4 web and 2 email people, and there was a big security breach that we had in our systems last year, and those people had to work insane hours to get everything back together again. The upshot of that was that we have a much better infrastructure today than what we had before. And then I've talked about advocacy and marketing. So those are the types of people that we have. Okay. Now, I did sort of lie when I said that, you know, it was all volunteers. Back in around 2000, Justin Gibbs, one of the early people in the FreeBSD, decided that he would set up a foundation, a 401c3, which is to say things contributed to it are tax deductible. Turns out that's a fair amount of work to do. It takes about 3 years with the IRS, if you're lucky, and don't have certain words in your title. At any rate, he got that, and for a long time, there was just small contributions, you know, $20,000-$30,000 a year. There was one person that worked, you know, part-time. But then in around 2005, they started to ramp up, and companies started really depending on FreeBSD, and they started being willing to help support that. And so today, there's an annual budget of about $750,000. Now, if you look at like the Linux Foundation, they just laugh at that. That's like, you know, they lose that in their couch probably. But for us, that's a significant amount of money. And those funds get used to support infrastructure work that people are, in fact, are not willing to do for free. I didn't run fast enough at the end of last year and got put on the board. If you've ever been on the board of a 501c3, your main job is to raise money. But you also get to, you know, pontificate a little bit on how it ought to be spent. And so, in fact, with the increase in resources that we've had, we've started essentially helping to get certain things done that were just not getting done. In particular, one of the things that turns out to be important is you want to have a set of independent contractors that are versant in this case FreeBSD, because companies that are first getting into FreeBSD often need help, and they want to have someone. They say, can you find us somebody that can help us? And it's like, well, yeah, actually we've got these set of people. But the problem is that's not steady work. A lot of these people, I mean, they could get a job with these companies, and the companies often want to hire them, but just the way their brains work is they want to be independent people, and so they don't take the jobs, but that means that they then have periods of time where they have like 3 months with nothing to do. And so what we do is we have these little projects that we need done, and we say, all right, well, here's a little three-month project, and we'll fund that for you, you know, sort of to fill in your income in the gap between now and when, you know, you have the next thing sort of lined up to do. And so we've gotten some amazing little bits and pieces of projects done. This year, for the first time, we've actually gone out on a limb and decided we're going to actually hire some people. So we actually hired a system administrator, believe it or not. We took the part-time person that was sort of dealing with the foundation and brought her up to full-time. And we've also brought on a couple of developers. But they're from Eastern Europe, and so the cost of a developer in Eastern Europe who thinks they're being paid a princely sum is about the cost of 1/3 of an employee in the United States. So it they just do amazing stuff for what seems like very little money. At any rate, there is this, the organization, if you went to the FreeBSD table, you saw a little thing about, you know, donate and et cetera, and you've got a hat or something. The foundation does in fact fill in a lot of these little gaps, little bits, like we want to push out a new version of the printed FreeBSD handbook. Well, that just takes somebody to sit down and do a lot of grunt work, and so we're actually paying to have that done. Okay, so it turns out, if any of you are thinking about doing these kind of foundation things, it's important to have a lot of small donors. If all you have is big companies giving you money, it very quickly makes you look like you're a shell for an industry organization, and you will lose your 501c3 status. So even though the companies provide the significant percentage of the total amount of money, the total budget, we have nearly 2,000 individual contributors every single year. So if you go over there and gave them even like $5 just so we can put your name down as a contributor, that helps a lot. And if you give them $25, they will be ecstatic. Okay. And you can go to the FreeBSDFoundation.org webpage and see the, there's a list of the contributors. If you did drill down, it's sort of interesting to see. Especially what are the companies that are there. And you'll also notice some of the really big contributions are anonymous. You go to a large company, then they say, well, we want our donation to be anonymous. And it's like, well, you know, wouldn't you like to have your name up there? Wouldn't, you know, the companies that use Linux love to say that we use Linux. Well, no, actually we don't. Well, why? Well, we actually sort of consider it a trade secret that we use FreeBSD, and if our competitors that are using Linux knew that we did that, they might switch and get a competitive, you know, we'd lose part of our competitive advantage. Not making this up. All right, moving along to licensing. Licensing is a large part of why the FreeBSD system is successful. So I need to talk a little bit about it. For those of you that came to the licensing talk earlier today, it was in much more depth. So this is just like scratching the surface of that subject. We have traditional copyright. This is what the big closed source companies use, along with other things like trade secrets and patents. They slap that on there, which says we get to decide how it will be distributed, and by the way, it won't. The source is not available, or if it is available, only in extremely restricted ways. Okay, so along comes Berkeley and the Free Software Foundation. We have GNU, which is often referred to as Copyleft, the GPL license, under the GPL2, you have to make the source available, including any of your own work. If you take Linux and all you ever do is stuff at home, you don't have to give it away. But as soon as you start shipping any kind of binary products to people, you also have to make the source available to those people. And that source has to be in an unencumbered way in which they can then use it for anything they want, including putting it back into the mainstream. And the problem with that is, many companies manage to do well with that with Linux because they're not putting their intellectual property into the operating system. They're doing stuff that runs on top of Linux. That's where their IP is. They're not required to give that away. But when the companies need to have their IP in the operating system, like network appliance, like, you know, companies that are building routers and other things, then they don't want to have to give their intellectual property away. And so copyright that doesn't require that is helpful. And that's why you find FreeBSD in so many of these more embedded sorts of things. Okay, well, not willing to leave well enough alone with GPL2, which actually was working just fine as far as I could tell. With GPL3, the source code and free use of any patents that would cover that have to be provided. Now, I'm paraphrasing here, so don't, like, you know, nail me too hard on this. This has freaked out the companies, because the way that a lot of them were continuing to control their intellectual property was they say, well, yeah, we'll give you the source code, but by the way, if you use it, then you've got to come pay patent rights to us. And this doesn't let them do that anymore. And so they're suddenly their IP is much more at risk to them, and so they can't cope with that. And this has caused a large fracture in the GPL community. So meanwhile, we've got the copyright, we've got copyleft. Berkeley is copy center. Take it down to the copy center, make as many copies as you want, do whatever you want with it. Just don't take the copyright notice out of the file. That's about the only constraint you have. And so since you're not forced to give stuff back, people say, well, that means, you know, it's constantly forking and, you know, companies are taking it private and you're, you know, the community is becoming dispersed. Well, the last time I checked, there were far more Linux distributions than there were BSD distributions. Yeah. And the other thing is that at an instant in time, like, you know, you can say, look, that company just took it and they're not giving anything back. But give me 6 years. Three distributions worth out of FreeBSD. Because what happens is that, let's say they start with FreeBSD 4 in their embedded product. Well, FreeBSD 4 didn't have multiprocessor support. FreeBSD 5 came out, it did have multiprocessor support. So they, turns out, you know, the boards they're buying to put in their products, they're starting to have multiple cores in them, and their product is built on a uniprocessor system, and they could make that multiprocessor, but that's a lot of work, you know, and if they just went to FreeBSD 5, then they'd, So they do. And then every little thing that they change, they've got to carry over and figure out how it works in the new system. Oh, like, where does this go now? Oh, I guess that's not there. Oh, no, it's over here. It burned me a second time. It's an enormous amount of engineering work to move from FreeBSD 4 to 5 because of all the proprietary, of all the changes they put in and didn't get back. So management, the people that are looking at the money, look at that and go, you know, there might be something to giving this stuff back, because if we had given that back, then it would have just been there and someone else would have maintained it and we wouldn't even had to have dealt with that bug and we wouldn't have had to deal with the moving it over. And so, you know, this is our intellectual property and all this other stuff, not really. So we'll give you that back. And so that first little trickle of stuff comes back. And then, you know, time moves on and they decide, well, we need to move to 6. Well, you know, there's still a lot of stuff they have to do to move to 6. And that circle of what's their intellectual property starts to shrink. It's like, well, you know, really, this just this little piece here, this is really our intellectual property. There's other stuff we could give that back. And so that comes back. And by the next release, 2 years after that, they're starting to give us stuff. It's like, no, really. This is really your stuff. You should take care of maintaining that. We don't really want to maintain that. So at the end of the day, whether it's by you know, voluntarily giving it to for their own self-interest, or in the case of copyleft because they're forced to, pretty much the same amount of stuff comes back. Because a lot of stuff comes back on copyleft, which is just, I mean, you just can't use it. You know, it's like, it does fix the problem, but it's ugly, and it's not maintainable, and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, and that's true of the stuff we get as well. I mean, there's no free lunch here. But the point is that the effectiveness of keeping community stuff coming back in has been about as effective, as far as I can tell, whether you have a Berkeley copyright or a copyleft. So, you know, that's where I am on licensing. Okay, so I'm just going to sort of finish up with a little bit of some of the new stuff that's going on in FreeBSD, and I'm mostly picking on things that actually would have some bearing to this group. The biggest single change is brought about because of GPL v3, and in particular the fact that the GCC compiler suite, that tool chain, which is what we have used since back in the Berkeley days, has switched to GPL v3. And because of the fact that that encumbers patents when you load against it, its libraries, that is a showstopper for the people that use FreeBSD. And so we simply cannot go and use that compiler. So we are stuck on the last release of GCC that was under the GPL v2 license. Now, in our ports tree, we have the most current versions of GCC because there are some ports that can't compile with the old GCC. But you can put anything you want out in the ports. It's up to the people that are deciding to include ports to decide whether that's going to affect them in a negative way. In the core system, we can't put that kind of stuff in. So we've been forced to switch to the LLVM compiler infrastructure and Clang and so on. This turns out to have been an incredible amount of work because you've got to have it across all your different architectures. There's, you know, will the ports compile with it, et cetera. Given a choice, we would never have done this. We did it because our hand was forced. Having done it with, well, in release 9, GCC, the old GCC is still the default compiler. The next release, 10 coming out next year, will have LLVM as the primary, as the default compiler. The old GCC will be available. The new one will be available as a port. At this point, more of the ports compile with LLVM than they do with GCC. So we're down to just a handful that still need GCC alone. And the handwriting is enough on the wall that most of those ports are eventually getting fixed. The ones that aren't are mostly because they're dark. Okay, so the having done all this, I will say that LLVM is a modern compiler. You know, GCC is 25 years old, and it shows. And so there's just things that you really wanted to be able to do differently. And so we have a lot of capabilities now with LLVM and so on that we didn't have before. So having done it, we actually got some benefit besides changing the license, but I would not wish that on anybody. Okay, for any of you that tried to install FreeBSD on, I'll say, your desktop, Jordan Hubbard, back in 1992, threw together a set of shell scripts that sort of used something that kind of looked vaguely like a, you know, it put a thing up on the screen and you could cursor around on it to check boxes, but that's about as close to a window thing as you could say that it was. It's like saying VI as a window system. It was a temporary fix until they got a chance to do something real, which happened about last year. So there's actually a new installer, BSD install, which is actually a true sort of graph GUI type of installation. Those of you that heard the PCBSD talk, they gave some screenshots of how that worked. The old people that are used to the shell scripts are like, grump, 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 grump. You know, I used to know how to do it, now I don't. It's like, yeah, sorry. You know, and there's still a command line interface, guys. The fast file system, which is the thing that's near and dear to my heart, we finally added JournalSoft updates. More interestingly for most people is ZFS, which was updated, this is slightly old slide, to version 28, now has been upgraded to version 5000 because 28 was the last one that came out of OpenSolaris. And when the group that's managing ZFS these days decided to do a new version, they decided to call it 5000, so it was really clear that it wasn't the same one that had come from Solaris. I don't know why they picked 5000, but that's what they picked. There's this thing called highly available storage, which is turns out to be very cool if you need to deal with, like, you're doing cloud services and you need to actually have your storage be reliable. Dtrace, which is a very effective tracing tool that came from Solaris, has been integrated. TCP/IP stack now supports what's called pluggable congestion control. For the longest time, there was the congestion control algorithm, but the problem is that the speed of networks is so wide now, that the orders of magnitude between the really fast networks and the slow ones is so great that there does not exist a single congestion control algorithm that makes sense across that entire bandwidth. And so there's a pluggable framework. There's actually 5 different algorithms that are sort of tiered for different networking speeds, and you just plug in the one that's appropriate. So the one that Netflix is going to use is going to be different than the one I use on my home system.
We have 5 minutes to conclude this presentation.
That's good, because I have 2 more bullet points and I'm done. NFS now supports version 4 and stuff for dealing with embedded systems. So, see, I told you. All right, if you're interested in FreeBSD, that's their home. If you want to donate money to the foundation, that's where you can do so. And then that's contact information for me. I actually have a 4-hour DVD version of this talk. I know, that sounds horrendous. But if you're interested in it, there's where you can get it. All right, so I have, like, what, 3 minutes for questions?
3 minutes for questions.
All right, 3 minutes for questions. Any questions? They're all asleep. No.
One of the things the Linux guys have done recently is they took the Plan 9 file system, and it was extended for Unix, and then they extended it for Linux semantics. Does FreeBSD have any support for the P9 stuff?
Not that I am aware of. We do have the Fuse framework, which allows you to run file systems in userland, and I believe there is a userland version of Plan 9 that's been done with Linux. So to the any Fuse file system you can run on Linux, you can run also on FreeBSD. In FreeBSD, our sort of philosophy is not to try and have everything. We try and say, all right, you know, these are the set of network cards that really work well, and we are going to support them really well. And the rest of them we just don't deal with. Whereas Linux, you know, there's a driver. If you can find a piece of hardware, there's probably a driver for it. And so it's sort of a philosophical difference. So the same thing with file systems. You know, we've got UFS and ZFS, and we put a lot of energy into making sure that those work. But we don't have a lot of others beyond that, other than ones that run with Fuse. Yeah.
Do corporations that rely heavily on FreeBSD contribute back as much as you expect, like Apple or NetApp, where like everything is built on top of it?
Both NetApp and Apple are good at getting stuff back to us. There are some that use it and probably should do better, but they just haven't been using it long enough. They'll get there. What's the future of FreeBSD? Right now, we're actually suffering a bit of a success disaster. We're having uptake by more companies than we're really organized to deal with. Mostly just that there's not enough people that are trained enough in it, and so the companies are, you know, wanting to hire people that are cognizant. Companies that make big use of it, we want to make sure they have one or two committers that are on their staff so that they have an easy way of getting stuff back. And we're getting kind of thin on having enough people that we can actually help with that.
As painful as pushing the pilot was, did you find that it forced you to put in place better practices, better things, and just fix something that should have been fixed a long time ago?
The question is, did we find that putting Clang in place forced us to change the way we did things? Yes. Yes. Did I say yes? All kinds of stuff had to change. It is. It absolutely has been a good thing. It's been a very painful thing. If I'd known how much work it was going to be, I would have tried to find a way around it. But having done it, it's definitely been a good thing.
One last question.
All right, you get the last question. I don't know that FreeBSD will ever overtake Linux, but it's in every Apple product. It's in every Android phone. It's in, you know, gazillions of things that you know, infrastructure. So it's in a lot of places.
I don't think it should be a competition. I think there's room in the free world for Linux and BSD as long as all we run is free.
What she said. Thank you.